special guest now joining us on the program, a gentleman who needs no introduction to me, but you may need an introduction. I grew up watching this gentleman on television where he was the dean, and I mean the dean of newscasters in the Philadelphia area, Larry Kane, joining us. His new work is out called When They Were Boys, The True Story of the Beatles' Rise to the Top. And Larry, I've got to tell you, it is a real pleasure professionally and personally to talk with you. And the first thing I want to say to you is congratulations on this book. I could not put it down. Great stuff.
Well, Tony, I really appreciate that. This is, as you know, my third book on the Beatles. The first one was Ticket to Ride, second one on John Lennon's life, which was a New York Times bestseller. This was the hardest because the truth of the matter is I knew these guys probably more intimately and saw more Beatles concerts than any human being except the Beatles, about 77 concerts when I traveled with them. But I really didn't know about the beginning. And there was so many theories, so much noise around about how they got started that I thought it would be interesting, and so did the publisher, for me to find out what the story was. And the story, like many things in life, what I attempted to find out and what I found out were totally different things. And the thing that I come away from in this book is several facts. Number one, they came so close, as you know from reading it, to having their music in some dustbin in history, laying around a garage somewhere. They were very, very lucky, extremely talented. But in the beginning, the talent was really a talent of creating frenzy among crowds and being such a tight band that they made dancers go into this cataclysmic frenzy where they couldn't control themselves. The songwriting talent came later. But before that, they were among 200 boy bands in Liverpool. It was just amazing what they did. To be perfectly honest with you, some of it could be called a bit of abuse in some ways. I mean, they cleaned toilets in a coffee shop just to get their start. They went to Hamburg, Germany, in conditions that you or I would never allow anybody we love to go into, where they lived partially in a bathroom, where they had to get penicillin every few days because they're involved with women, working women, and not the kind of working women you and I know, okay? And finally, they were in fear of these nightclub goons who wanted them to entertain 18 hours a day, who would take cricket bats and smack them around the head, and they finally got into a relationship with a man named Horst Boscher, who's still alive, who was a convicted killer. You and I could sit down in Tennessee and have coffee or a beer and never be able to make this story up.
And the thing that I love about your work, Larry, is that there are several questions about the Beatles that to this day, 50 years later, remain open-ended. For instance, Pete Best's demise with the band, Stuart Sutcliffe's death. I mean, those that follow the Beatles, these are open-ended questions that I guess will never be answered. And the thing I love about what you've done here is you say, this is what I've learned through the interviews and through the research I've done. But yet, we can't make conclusions about any of this because truly, they're pretty tight-lipped about their history, aren't they? Those guys, when they walked away, they were tight-lipped.
Yeah, John Lennon, if he were alive, probably would have been more expressive than George, Paul, or Ringo are. There are stories and secrets that will never come out from them because they don't want them out. First of all, I love them. They're great guys. There are parts of their personal life and their professional life that they don't want out. The Pete Best demise, I am told by Pete Best's brother and the family that they believe that the depiction of what happened to him in this book is the closest thing to reality. And basically what happened to him was very simple. He was a very good fine drummer. Both he and Ringo were replaced with session drummers later on as the music started to unfold. Pete Best was a man who, without question, was very subdued as a person. He may have not been as energetic as the others, but he was extremely handsome and very charismatic, unlike me. He was very charismatic, and he was the number one Beatle in the early years of the Beatles from 1960 through the middle of 1962 on every magazine cover, on every single placard. Stories were written about him. They called him mean, moody, and magnificent. He was not the leader, but the most popular Beatle. And it was true that in those early concerts in late 1961 through the spring of 1962, through June of 1962, that girls would go up and try to push away Paul and John's legs and George's legs so they could get a glimpse at Pete. And it all came to a head on one very dramatic night in the Manchester Playhouse in 1962. And I'll tell the story, even though it's in the book, I'm going to tell the story because I think it's so significant. I've got five eyewitnesses who were there. When Brian Epstein, their manager, and that's a whole other story for the ages, his life, Brian Epstein took the parents of the Beatles on a luxury motor coach to Manchester, where they entertained in a place called the Manchester Playhouse. And he wanted to show them how well they were doing, which is a very nice touch. The only parent who didn't go was Pete Best's mother, Mona, who sadly, or triumphantly, was pregnant with, or just nursing the child of Neil Aspinall, their 20-year-old road manager, and she was 40. And today, Pete is very proud of his brother, Rogue, R-O-A-G, who manages most of what's left of Pete's empire. And they entertained that night, and it was a crazy night, because as usual, the fans went crazy, but they wanted Pete. Everybody wanted Pete. And at the end of the concert, they couldn't get Pete out of there. They got Paul and George and John out of the bus. The bus had to keep circling the community, circling the street, because they couldn't get Pete out because the girls were running after him in a rage. And then one of the police officers decided that they were going to put Pete in a hamper to sneak him out. They put him in this hamper, but the girls kept running after him. One of them slashed through the hamper with the scissors, and she got into the hamper with him. And she, you know, he was kind of frightened. She took the scissors and went for his chest to get a piece of his shirt.
Oh my!
She was not leaving without a souvenir, and she stabbed him. She stabbed him in the chest, not fatally, of course, but she stabbed him enough to cause him to bleed. And they finally moved him into the bus. Blood was dripping down his shirt and into his trousers. And supposedly the nicest man in Liverpool, who I never met, of course, because he died before I could meet him, James McCarthy, Paul's father, went up to Pete, shaked him by the lapels, and said, "Are you happy now? You've shown up the boys again." 1 month later,
he's out.
He was fired from the band, primarily at the urging of Paul McCartney and George Harrison. But there's a backstory here that a lot of people don't understand. This fellow, Neil Aspinall, who was their road manager, one of the two road managers, was very smart. He became the father, of course, of Pete's brother. And he was really almost irreplaceable by the Beatles. When Pete was fired, they got together. And over a three-day period, Neil Aspinall said, "If you're gone, I'm gone." They were best friends. They were closest of friends. And Pete said to him, and you talk about altruism, you talk about unselfishness, Pete said, "Whatever you do, do not leave this band. They're going to become big, and you're going to be part of it." And eventually he relented. He eventually became the CEO, chief executive officer, of the Beatles, post-Beatles empire, Apple. And he became a gazillionaire. And toward the end of his tenure there, he died a few years ago, he gave the Best family $11 million to cooperate with the Beatles anthology. I'm sure you remember the video and the book.
Yeah.
And although he cooperated and the family got the money, which they were grateful for, nothing in that book features Pete Best. So, to make a long story short, at Aspinall's funeral, of course, the entire Best family was there because he was related to them. And Rogue Best was there because it was his dad. And Yoko Ono was there. And Olivia Harrison was there. And Paul McCartney's daughters were there. And the entire Beatles family was represented. But Ringo and Paul decided to pay their respects in private. Now, they had not paid their respects in private, they would have been there for the first time in 50 years and seen Pete Best up close in person. So why didn't they go?
Okay. And you love these guys.
Why haven't they talked to him
in
52 or 53-plus years?
It's remarkable.
And you know, there's a lot of theories about that. I'm not saying that they're non-confrontational. They're wonderful people. There's no finer performer in the world than Paul McCartney. Mm-hmm. And there's no nicer man than Ringo Starr. So what was the problem? I don't understand that. The beginning is the beginning. The end was a different story, but he was there at the beginning. So, you know, a lot of that's in this book, but there's also some stories that are just, I believe, Tony, that are really unbelievable about the way they were and the way they are. And some of them outline some of the most extraordinary unselfish acts I've ever seen. To give you an example, this is not necessarily a part of this book, but when I travel with them, they had a routine every night. There were opening artists for their shows. Some of them included artists like the Righteous Brothers, which were a great team. They had two of the most listened to songs of all time, Lost That Loving Feeling and Unchained Melody, which I'm told is one of the most listened to records in the history of the world. And they had Clarence Frogman Henry, and they had Jackie DeShannon, who was a teenage star at the time. And every night these artists would come out and nobody would listen to them. They were totally ignored, and the crowd would scream, "We want the Beatles, we want the Beatles." And sensing what they were going through, the four guys were amazing. Every night they would get on the plane. Once the plane got safely where they could take seatbelts off, they'd have a smoke, they'd have a drink, they'd freshen up. And the first thing they did every night was go to the front of the plane and talk to the artist, kneel down with them, and see if they were okay. To me, that showed an extraordinary amount of class. And that class, as a young artist, was exhibited each and every night. It's interesting, though, as time went on and their privacy became an issue with them, they did enclose themselves because Paul McCartney lives in a bubble now, a real security bubble, and I don't blame him for that.
Mm-hmm.
And Ringo Starr is quite, I would say, quite reclusive. So basically, in those days when I got to know them and through their adult lives, they really are stellar people. They're not the kind of people who would embarrass anybody. Smash guitars, do the things that got people attention. They're not Led Zeppelin. They would never be Led Zeppelin. They're not Pink Floyd. They'd never be Pink Floyd or The Who. They are just wonderful young men who made it big and who gave us, more than anything, a legacy of music. And that music is discovered and broken down in a certain way in this book that tells you how it really got started. And I'm happy that you loved it. The fact that you loved it, Tony, is more important than anything else.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. I think any person that loves rock and roll, any kind of history, I'm a naturally curious person, Larry, and I watched you through the years, through the news, and I knew you were the guy that back in the day had gotten the privilege and the honor to travel with those guys, and you talk about that some here. But the other thing that stands out to me is when you look at their story, and you alluded to this off the top, was how many times they had situations where if they take this fork in the road, we may not have ever known the Beatles, or if they didn't get a break, or if Mona Best didn't jump in there, or when they came back and didn't play their seminal show that they played after their failed and terrible time that they had over in Hamburg. Could you elaborate just how close we came to not seeing the Beatles?
Well, you have a very interesting point there, because there was a concert they had after Hamburg. They felt they were pretty well washed up after Hamburg. And so they quit. George was trying to go back to school as an apprentice electrician. Paul was told by his dad, get a day job. You'll never be able to make money this way. And they were pretty down. And the only person who kept them going, and this is the real irony of it, was Mona Best. Mona Best was a show woman, and she really said, hang in there. If there's any one person who didn't get the credit that was deserved for the formation of the Beatles and keeping them strong, in my view, it was Mona Best. There were two other people, actually, Sam Leach, the early promoter, and the press guys who really aspired to create an imagery for them. But Mona Best didn't get the credit. But anyway, in this December 1960 period, it was cold and damp in Liverpool, and John Lennon was staring into the wall and very, very depressed. George and Paul figured it's up. Pete was pretty cheerful because Pete was always kind of cheerful and never worried about too much. And finally, they got an offer to perform at this place called Litherland Town Hall, which is basically right now a very important health center for the National Health Program in England. It's no longer a town hall. And they had a concert there. And in those days, in 1960, 59, 58, kids in Liverpool would pay 20 cents or 10 cents or whatever it was to go and dance to a good band. And the Beatles were a great band. Whatever you want to say about the early days, they were tight. And when I eventually listened to all those concerts on tour, I can actually say, for those of you who remembered what a record was, that when you listen to them in their habitat on stage, everything they did sounded like the record. Remember the Rolling Stones a few years ago at the Super Bowl and how bad it was? Everything they did was like the record. But anyway, they went to this town hall place, and they got paid about $7. And the kids were dancing, and they were playing some Little Richard, a little bit of Elvis, a little bit of the Everly Brothers. And all of a sudden, the kids went into a frenzy. Boys and girls started rushing the stage. And when they started rushing the stage, they convinced some teenage promoters that there's something about this band. And the next person offered them $10 a week, and then $12 a concert, and they started to get some action. There are people in Liverpool who call this concert small beer. That's an expression they use for uneventful events. And the fact is that this concert actually gave them the willpower to carry on. And it was very, very significant.
For them, almost like a turning point.
It was a turning point. So basically, when you look back at that, that was a turning point. If they didn't have Litherland, who the hell knows what would have happened. They had a guy named Sam Leach, who was this toothy, still a toothy 75, 77-year-old guy who was there, this master promoter, and he brought them to a place called the Tower Ballroom, where he got them booked with, believe it or not, with Little Richard. He sneaked in another concert at another place during the same night. People around Liverpool started to know them, and then something else happened. They had a friend whose name is Bill Harry. Bill Harry is thankfully still in the living world. He decided, much like my early career, that he wanted to be a journalist, but he went fast forward. And he created a magazine called the Mersey Beat. Not one biographer, not one, from Mark Lewison to the best in the world, I mean the best, or a researcher has ever given Bill Harry the true credit he deserves. Bill Harry was determined to use his newspaper to make the Beatles a success. Mersey Beat at one point was being read by 2,000 or 3,000 kids in Liverpool. He created it with a $500 loan from Virginia, who became his wife. He said, that's the least I could do as mayor. I've been married for 55 years. It's amazing what he did. There was a DJ who ran the Cavern Club named Bob Wooler, who wrote a column in this paper, and it was called The Stuff That Screams Are Made Of. Well, that article just created such an imagery about the Beatles. And then Bill Harry did what nobody dared to tell the truth about, which he now does. He took a survey of the most popular groups in Liverpool, and he put a top 10 out. And the fact is, he heard that Farron and the Flamingos and Jerry and the Pacemakers and some of the other big groups and Billy J. Kramer, who eventually was given incredible music by the Beatles for his own repertoire, were stuffing the ballot boxes. Well, whether they were stuffing them or not, Harry and his future wife, Virginia, decided to rig the poll and make the Beatles number one. They rigged the poll. So all of a sudden, there's this headline that said, Beatles number one in Liverpool. And it was distributed all around the country. Now, he says to me today, they were number one, so I wasn't going to deprive them of that, so we decided to maneuver the poll. I have no problem with that. I think it was funny. Okay? So these headlines and the work of Tony Barrow, their later press secretary, and the work of Derek Taylor, who's a star writer, the creation of the imagery was incredible. And I'm not saying they didn't have the talent, because once they started writing, the talent just blossomed. And I want to explain something to Tony. There's two aspects of the Beatles, and a lot of people really don't understand this. When I met them in Miami, and then they were coming to this gigantic tour of 1964, I wrote a letter to Brian Epstein, and I put some perfume letters from fans inside of it, and he invited me to come on the entire tour to travel with them. The sum was $3,000 for 36 days. You can imagine how cheap that was in that time.
Oh,
I would travel in their plane. I would be a part of their official traveling party. And it turned out I was the only American to travel to every stop with them. And it was kind of fascinating because I did not want to go. 1964 was the year that a gigantic story was happening in my hometown of Miami. And that story was the Cuban exodus, where 2,000 or 3,000 Cubans were coming there every day, some of them losing their lives across the Florida Straits to get out of the the butcherous Castro regime. People forget that Castro was a butcher,
mm-hmm.
and he was killing people. And it's easy for people to forget history. Muhammad Ali was known as Cassius Clay. He was training a few blocks from my studio, and I got to know him. And I watched his victory over Sonny Liston in the second row at Miami Beach Auditorium. And then there was a bigger story developing, the escalation of the conflict in Southeast Asia, the aftermath of the assassination of the president. And I said to my bosses, I said, send Aditya. Don't send me, because the fact is, you and I both know, this band will be here in September and gone in November. And that's the end of the story. Now, that was one of my greatest visions, as you know, from history. And they did talk me into going. And did I know in 1964, 1965, 1967, 1968, with the final interview with Paul and John together, 1970, did I know up until John Lennon's death that the Beatles were to be the Beatles? The Beatles didn't know they were the Beatles. They thought they were a great band that would be remembered very well, but did they know that they would become the iconic classics over the last 50 years? That Brian Epstein's comment to me in 1964, Larry, the Beatles will be listened to by the children of the 21st century? Did I know any of that was true? The answer is no.
Did Brian Epstein believe that? Or was he spinning that?
He absolutely believed it.
He believed it.
And he never lived to see it, but he believed it. And I thought he was crazy. I said, you're kidding me? You're saying that the kids that are teenagers, and I get 15, 20 requests a week from people all over the country for interviews, mostly, get this, teenagers 13 and 14 years old, the same ages that the 64 and 65-year-olds who remember them now were? No. Did I know that? The fact is, when you're in the middle of history, you never know what history is going to bring. And I traveled with this band, and I came back from the travels and couldn't wait to travel with them again. And I am not a music man. Let me make that very clear. But I could not wait to go back. In fact, they invited me a couple of months later to come to Nassau when they filmed the movie Help. And I was invited over to England. And I had, until he died, a 16-year relationship with John Lennon that brought me all around the world to see him. And I'll never forget the day in May, which I'm sure you remember a little bit of, 1975, when John was fighting to retain his green card status in the United States,
mm-hmm.
when this guy, and yours truly, and a great salesman, invited him to Philadelphia for a Helping Hand weekend for WFIL Radio. And he came down, and the DJ said, he's never coming, he's never coming. I said, he's coming. And I picked him up at 30th Street Station, the Amtrak station. I took him over to 4100 City Line Avenue. Thousands of people showed up for the entire weekend. He was in his splendor, and he went on the radio, and then he said, I want to go on television with you. And I said, well, I could put you out at the end of the show, or we could do something. And he said, I'll do the weather. And that night, he did the weather on Channel 6 in Philadelphia, and crowds streamed day and night to the station studio. And he remembered, because he lost a mother so young, he remembered that part of the charity money was going to the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, a disease that killed my mother. And I remembered the talks that he and Paul McCartney had with me on the plane. They found out that my mother died some weeks earlier, and they wanted to talk to me about the fact that Paul lost his mother when he was 14, John when he was 18. These guys remembered. John Lennon remembered. So did I know in those days, before John was murdered, that the Beatles would become iconic? And let's face it, they didn't really become iconic until years passed. And when people started realizing the enormous nature of the impact of their incredible music.
And their music is incredible. There's just no doubt. Talk about things that stand the test of time, or things artistically that folks will be listening to, passed down from generation to generation. You can easily see a world where in a couple hundred years, just as we listen to the great classics from the classical composers, you can see the Beatles juxtaposed with those folks through time.
Question.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Tony. Well, you talk.
I love you, Larry, because you're so passionate about this. Before we started, you said, 15 or so minutes. Larry, we're going 30, and you can't stop, because the truth is, and I can tell in your work how passionate you are, because you didn't cut corners. A couple things stand out to me here. Why is it so much has been written about this group, yet there are so many blind spots in their history, and you haven't been afraid to touch them in this work, though you maintain a good relationship with these guys and a close relationship with the Living Beatles and their families, and you have to be somewhat, I would think, sympathetic to that as you put pen to paper or get behind your computer. Why, with the historians, though, are there, Larry Kane, so many blind spots when it comes to these guys and ignored players through their history?
I think Mark Wilson's done a good job. I think a few others have done a good job, but I don't hold the sole license for telling the truth. I will tell you this. I have a nice relationship with them. So I have a very close relationship with Yoko Ono. I'm not afraid to tell the story. The story is the story. The fact is that there's a lot of vacant spots because they never talk. And this happened to Mark Lewison, who's a great researcher. He couldn't get them to talk either. They never talk because they don't want to tell their story. And there's a reason they don't want to tell their story. It's not that there's anything untoward. It's a difficult story to tell, and I'll tell you the honest God's truth. They don't remember. That's another story. They don't remember. And I'm not saying that they don't remember. They don't want to remember. I think they do. Ringo once said to me, "Larry, you tell me what happened because I don't remember a damn thing." And fortunately, from the tour standpoint and the beginning, there's nobody else who can tell the story. And it's all on tape. I want to tell you something. People who write books do not make a lot of money. It's not money. It's really the pride of doing it. I don't care if only 10 people read the book or 100,000 or a million. I think that the bottom line to all of this is that the story may never be known completely. A lot of the people who could tell the story are dying, not there. So I figured, you know, I'll do it. I'll tell it. It's not, you know, this is, I'm not Ernest Hemingway. It's not a 1,000-page book. It's a 415-page book. I have to give tremendous credit to the photo editor who followed everything right through. You see the whole transformation of them from this sort of punk rock band into, the, you know, this look. And by the way, if you want to think that, yeah, that adults were not upset about the Beatles. Before I left, I have to tell you this, Tony, before I left on the tour, my father pulled me aside, tough World War II veteran, okay? And he said, "I have one piece of advice. Watch your back, Larry. They are a menace to society." And they were the cleanest cut band in the world, you know? So that just showed you the threat that all these adults felt about them. Isn't that a funny line?
That's a great line. And I'm sure it was oft-repeated by folks of his generation. Hey, Larry, really appreciate the time. Hey, congratulations again on this book. Yeah.
Thank you, Tony.
I really appreciate your time, Larry. Thank you, man. What a thrill for me to get to talk to you.
Yeah. Thank you. Happy New Year.
All right, same to you. Bye now.